Local writer, teacher and long-time RTRFM friend Laurie Steed is here to talk about his latest offering, a memoir, Confessions of an Anxious Father, Love, Dad. G'day, Laurie.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm really well. Congrats on your new book.
Well, it's an amazing journey I've been on with this book, so it's very wonderful to be in front of you talking about the completed text.
A hard copy.
Yeah, it's a pretty magic moment, and especially surreal in a good way, to think that it's a book about me and my family. And there's no whistles and bells on that, and there doesn't need to be because it's quite a life we've lived.
Before we talk much more about Love, Dad, let's head back to late 2019.
Okay.
When you chatted regularly with Taylor Strano as the man who loves everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Feels like a long time ago to me. What about you?
Yeah, look, a lot happened between then and now. So it's funny, I went back and I listened to some of the episodes of The Man Who Loves Everything, and it seems like a strangely idyllic pre-lockdown time where two wonderful people got to talk about wonderful things and celebrate some magic. And yet I think on some level there was a couple of those sessions where I talked to Taylor in the lockdown as well, and we were sort of reflecting on what all that means. One in particular that comes to mind was Walking the Cow. We talked about the song and, you know, the need for hope and a little bit of vulnerability and everything in the space. So, yeah, for me it was a real touchstone for this book. And it's funny that The Man Who Loves Everything started out of a list that I'd written after the death of my friend Jeremy, who I talk about in Love, Dad. And so there was sort of a full circle moment in both The Man Who Loves Everything as both a starting point and a continuation. And then as I wrote Love, Dad, Jeremy kept wanting to be in the book. And I was like, well, this is a book about fathers and sons. And he was quite persistent. Mm-hmm. And I guess something inside of me was quite persistent in wanting to look at that and see how he not only shaped me in his death, but in his life as well. And once I got into that space, it was a pretty vulnerable space, but it was a kind of a heartening thing to think that we choose what we focus on, even in the most traumatic times. And I feel really lucky to have had him as a friend now, and I feel very lucky to have had Taylor as a friend during those idyllic months and in the midst of a lockdown too. It's been a journey.
Yeah, it's only 4 years ago, but in lots of ways, like life, Laurie, it's blink, blink, and it's 4 years ago. But it also feels like a different kind of time.
Yes. Yes, I'd agree with that. And I think one of the big things that happens, which I talk about in Love, Dad, is Dad's more recent health problems. So I do recall at about October 2020, when I was doing a retreat up in the Perth Hills teaching writers, and it was a Sunday morning, and my phone buzzed with a text and said, your father's had a heart attack. Mm-hmm. He's on the way to Northern Hospital. And I thought, well, I have to teach this, the last of this retreat, and then what I'm going to do is I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to go to Royal Perth, and we're going to continue on something that had started 8 years prior. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the journey with my dad, there was this sort of massive rupture in about 2013. And then life had its ups and downs between that period. And then I was sort of moving towards quite a groovy, hopeful place, thinking this was a place of strength. And then I guess the universe was like, well, what are you going to do when things hit a valley? And how are you going to find hope and faith? So yeah, the time between The Man Who Loves Everything and now has been a real exercise in faith and hope, and also real mindfulness about my boys and knowing that I could anchor them, hopefully, in a really tumultuous time in ways I hadn't expected. So you have this personal storm with my father being unwell, and then you have a global reality of everyone in great stresses. So one of the funniest things about writing Love, Dad is that early on I say, and when my firstborn is into the world, suddenly I'm stuck at home all the time and I can't go anywhere. And then I had to put in the edit, this is pre-lockdown, of course, because at that time there was no lockdown. It was just the reality. So I think it's interesting how important connection is in all of this. So one's mind can play little tricks on oneself and say, yes, it is that bad. Yes, you are alone. And that only feeds as long as you don't connect with other people. And the moment you do it again, you go, hey, it's okay. Like, it's almost like working with your own child and saying, hey, you're okay, buddy, I'm here. Yeah. You're all right.
Got your back.
Yeah.
You mentioned it being an exercise in faith and optimism. Being raised a Jedi, do you have a faith? Have you forgiven yourself for your flaws?
Wow, I'm still working on it. I have to admit, in the lead up to Love Dad coming out, was the first time my inner critic returned and was like, well, hey, what's going to happen with this book? Where's it going to go? And I kept saying, I don't know, and that's okay. The book is the gift. The rest is a bonus. In terms of my own faith, I think the world is kind of like my family, for lack of a better phrase, in the sense that it gives me these reminders that there's something that's really beautiful in the life that I'm living. And so it often comes through moments of connection, but it also comes through surprise moments with people I didn't think I was going to connect with. So that was one of the stranger things, I think, revisiting the book and thinking about it, was that I noticed that when I was at my lowest, someone would show up and it wouldn't be necessarily who I thought was going to show up, but someone would show up.
And I think we can relate to that. Yes. A lot of us find in times of crisis, for want of a better word, I'm not sure there is a better word, when you're feeling that need, it's often not the person you expect it to be.
No, and what's really challenging, or certainly I found challenging in my own life, is probably a twofold thing. And one is going, whatever was the script prior to this point doesn't necessarily need to be the script going forward from this point. And the other is a willingness to stay open at one's most vulnerable or at one's most challenged and say, okay, I need help. I'm struggling right now. I don't need to shut out and close off everything. I actually need some help right now. So that's partly why I wrote Love Dad too, because I thought there's probably some dads out there and all kinds of people really who think, I'll just keep on pushing it and I'll keep on pushing it and I'll get to this next point. And there's some merit in that. Our body knows though, and our feelings want to come out. So if we listen, that starts a different kind of narrative and a sense of enoughness that you can't really get without being vulnerable, I don't think.
You reveal a lot even in the title, Love Dad, Confessions of an Anxious Father. So that anxiety is on the front cover, Laurie. Was it always going to be called Love Dad?
Well, Love Dad was within the text, which is how my dad obviously signed off all his letters, and probably a lot of dads do. Originally, it was called Better Than Me, funnily enough. And I think it was like Stories of a Dad or something like that. Georgia, the editor, Georgia Richter, gave me a surprise gift during the edit when she said, you know what's the commonality about this book? And I said, no, not really, just that life's a struggle and that there's a mountain to climb and you've got to keep climbing. And she said, no, it's anxiety. And I thought, is it anxiety? And not everyone does this. Not everyone freaks the hell out about certain things when they're coming through. And, of course, anxiety is anchored to all kinds of life experiences and things like that sometimes too. It was really helpful that Georgia started that conversation, because then I was no longer someone to sort of conquer, as in my anxiety wasn't there to get in my way. It was trying to help me work with my reality, and I could manage it, and I could treat myself with so much more self-compassion, knowing there was something tangible that was affecting my perception of the world and of fear and of things to be worried about. There was a few sort of transcendent moments in that same time period where someone said to me, I'd say, oh, I don't want to do this. I can't do this. And they'd say, why don't you just go and just see how it goes on the thing? And you can go early if you want to go. And I went to certain events or a catch up or whatever, and I had a really good time. And I thought, oh, I was really worried about that. And it's okay that I was worried about it, but it's also okay to gauge it each time and go, am I going to do this? How do I feel about this? And I guess really start to notice what's self-care and what is sort of anxiety next level and impinging my ability to connect with people.
Especially your sons.
Yeah, my gosh, yeah. So I think the perfectionism tying in with anxiety was such a big thing for me. And suddenly I've got this beautiful, perfect boy in front of me. And it seemed so crazy that I'd been so willing to put this incredibly hard line on me once he showed up. And then it was like, well, even if I've done this with myself for most of my life, there's no way I can do this with this boy. Like, he's perfectly imperfect, whatever way you want to phrase it. He has flaws, but they're beautiful flaws and necessary flaws. And so as a dad, I just wanted to be able to accept all of him as best I could and support him in ways perhaps I hadn't been at certain points in my life. And it seemed like a pretty good mission and a great way to spend my days.
I don't want to reveal a lot of the stories because they're beautifully placed in chapters.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much, Laurie. It's a dip in and out. Yeah. I love it. But I did want to share this line because it makes me chuckle even when I think about it now, about what time children wake up and yes. what goes on and how 6 o'clock is still early if it is every morning for the foreseeable future.
Yes.
So true.
There's this phrase, there's a song, I think it's by Rob Mills, so I don't think we've ever played it on RTR, but it's called Every Single Day for the Rest of Your Life. And every now and again, it'll just play on a loop in my head while I'm with the boys. 6 o'clock in the morning is a very early time to wake up. And you start to realize this is going to happen every single day, and you're probably never going to quite catch up on your sleep pattern. So I downloaded the sleep app, and it said you've got like a 10-hour sleep debt. I still have a 10-hour sleep debt. That never changed over time. And the other thing is that everything is about the kids once they're there, and that's necessarily so. It can be challenging, though, in the sense that one time I ate the last mini muffin from the bread bin, and my eldest, Noah, he goes to me, he says, Josh is very angry at you. And I said, why? Why would he be angry at you? And he said, you ate the last mini muffin. And then he said, I'm so angry at you. Noah said it as well. And I went, what, you're both angry at me about the mini muffin? So one has to really control one's, you know, those moments you might have had prior to having children where you go, oh, I think I will have that last bit of chocolate, or oh, I think I will watch that documentary on this. So I'm well versed in children's music, children's cinema, and children's cuisine since they showed up.
I want to talk about music. Mm. It's no surprise, as a man who loves everything, loves a lot of music. I love how technology has developed, Laurie. We can have a playlist that goes with our book. Before I knew you had a playlist, I was thinking, should I play Raining Tacos?
Such a classic track.
I had to look it up.
And now it's incredible, right?
I had to get the Red Sun in my head so
you tracked it down?
I moved it down, yes.
Yeah, it's quite the track, isn't it? It's got a real kick on it initially. And interestingly, it was a Japanese band recorded it first, and I can't remember what their title was, and then this Cantonese artist Hacken Lee takes it on, and talking to my friends who are from China, they say, oh, of course I know that song, that's like an anthem, like it's one of the biggest songs in history. And I thought, well, isn't it amazing how technology gets me to this song? I've never found, at the point of crisis, I find a song that says, okay, we'll do this together, we'll get through it. And
did you know that? Are you a fluent Cantonese
Not at
speaker?
All. No, no. So I literally looked it up because I was curious as to why I was getting emotional every time the song came on. And so I found a pretty handy translation of what it was saying. And then I also found the video, which I watched with the boys. And the video is just, it's just magic. It's very funny. It's not like the song. But it's got some apt metaphors. Yep. So you've got Hacken Lee right up on the screen, and someone hits an egg on his head, and then someone else throws water on him, and he's just in this total turmoil and storm.
But it's not quite Raining Tacos.
No,
he doesn't have tacos.
He doesn't have tacos. And there's something, can I tell you a funny story about the Raining Tacos Red Sun axis? Is that when I originally wrote the ending of the book, I was like, do I have license to make it Red Sun? And it's a very powerful moment. I'm leaving my father and Red Sun's playing. And his wife goes, no, you'd be lying. Like, it's Raining Tacos. That's what's playing. And I'm like, it is Raining Tacos. And I'm just going to have to wing it and hope that's the thing, because that's what was playing. And I think it is the perfect song for it. It's just funny as a parent, this sort of need to try to exert some small sense of control only to realize it's Raining Tacos and you've got no chance. So, in my launch speech, my friend David, who launched the book, he said, it's Raining Tacos in my heart, Laurie, And I hope it's raining tacos in your heart too. So I think it's a lovely metaphor and it's so surreal. And then there's that whole melodic side of it where, because of its heritage, you're still feeling emotional and you're going, why am I feeling emotional about a song about lettuce and cheese?
Because basically it rips off
Falkenberg's Canon, yeah. So it's really funny that you've got... This is how earworms work so often these days. And so people go, oh, I love that song. And I go, they say, oh, I love Do You Think I'm Sexy by Rod Stewart. And I go, no, you don't love Do You Think I'm Sexy by Rod Stewart. You love Taj Mahal. And you just haven't heard Taj Mahal. And so you don't know that that's the same song, basically. So there's usually an incredibly brilliant composer behind whatever the big hit of the day is, but no one knows that.
Before we go down a Taj Mahal rabbit hole, which yes, we could both spend some time in, Laurie Steed, you're a teacher and a short story writer. How did you get to the memoir?
It was an accident. It was wholly an accident, and it came about because the short story collection, which is coming out in February next year with UWA Publishing, was in a very tough place. And so what I got was an opportunity to go to Varuna, the writer's house in the Blue Mountains.
Lovely.
And it was called the Henry Handel Richardson Flagship Fellowship for Short Story Writing, and it comes every 2 years.
That's longer than some short stories.
I know, right? It's not flash fiction, it's almost. So I got that fellowship and felt a lot of pressure, like, in a great canon of writers who've had this, I'm going to work on the short story collection, it'll be fine. And then I rang my friend Dash, who's in the book, and I said, I'm not feeling this at all. I don't know how I'm going to write this short story collection. And either helpfully or unhelpfully, he says to me, well, if you go there and you write nothing, this will be the time that you wrote nothing at the writer's house. And I was like, I think, thank you, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's a good story, but yeah, not sure I want that
I'm not
story.
Sure I want that story in my life. So then I get on this plane and I start writing about being a dad. And I had previously written two short pieces for the Centre for Stories on being a father, but they were standalones and I hadn't really thought that could actually be a full text. But on the plane, these words just started coming about leaving my boys for the first time in 7-8 years. And then I'm on the train and I'm in a flow state. And then this young guy gets on, sort of 25 with a goatee beard and a beanie and this sort of esky-looking thing and four poles. And he keeps smiling at me. And my first thought is, that guy's really getting on my nerves. I just want to write. But the other thought said, no, you're going to talk to him and you're going to find out why he's smiling and what his deal is. And so I talked to him, and he doesn't have a fixed abode. He just sets up his tent in the Blue Mountains and camps out there in the dark. And I say to him, I'm going to Varuna to work on this book, but I don't know if I want to work on that book, and I'm a bit nervous about it. And he smiles, and he says, well, you'll just be the mountains. You'll just be the trees. You'll be your fingers on the keyboard and the wind through, the whistling through. And I thought, wow, will I? That's amazing. That's interesting. I don't know how that works, but that sounds cool. And he says, the darkness is the best. He says, the darkness is before you find out what's going to happen. And it's really exciting. And I was like, I don't know what's going on in the bushes when you stay out there. Hopefully that's good darkness or whatever's coming through. And then by the time I got to Verona, the writer's house, you meet with a consultant. And I said, hi, I'm here for this fellowship. I'm meant to be working on the short story collection. The other thing is I've been working, writing these stories about being a dad on the way over. And she looked at me and she got that same Alex smile, the guy from the train. And she goes, do it. And I said, what? She goes, do it. I said, but can I do it? And she goes, yes, you can do it. And then I said, well, how? What am I going to do? And she goes, I don't even care. She says, I don't want to see you again for the whole time you're here. I just want you to go and write that book. So I sit down. I work out how many words I'm going to hit every day to get to a full manuscript of about 75. And I think it was about 5,500.
Plenty.
So I put on Genesis, A Trick of the Tail record every morning as I walk, and I walk around the Blue Mountains, and then I come back and I write and I stop for lunch and then I write again, and then at night I converge with all the other writers there and we talk about, I think it was the end of the second week, I said to the writers who are in residence, I've never been more me on a residence in my lifetime, so thank you. Because it felt like not only was I me on the page, but I wasn't trying to impress anyone. I had sort of coming back to Varuna, because the first time I went was 2012 before the boys were born. It felt like if this is it, this is okay. Like it's amazing how much pressure writers put on themselves to be some sort of satellite when really they just need to be a human being and put those words on the page and be real, raw and vulnerable. So that was a huge lesson for me in bringing Love Dad to life. And as I went more and more into it, Georgia was really comfortable with going, hey, you know that bit where you kind of veer away from intimacy or you veer away from vulnerability? I'd really like you to stay there. So there's a couple of chapters in there. There's one with my dad in York and about the middle where she wanted me to stay in the room.
Mm.
And so I did, and I cried when I wrote it, but I'm really glad I did.
I often joke that high school's at a really bad time for adolescents because, well, adolescents.
Mm.
And I wonder if being a father is sometimes at a difficult time because others' expectations are that we should be, you know, doing other things and working and earning and being provider, man as provider, rather than man as father.
Mm. Yeah, I think that a father, both roles are so vital. Like any parenting or caring role in a child's life is massive and it's enough. So my experience, while I'm currently working full-time again, is that at the times when I wasn't working full-time, I got an understanding of how important it was to be there for the boys at these micro moments. So it might be the drop-off, it might be the pick-up.
Mm-hmm.
It could be all kinds of things, even first thing in the morning too. So sometimes I try and get exercise in first thing in the morning. I didn't really like that because I liked that they came in and I was there. And the same way, I find evening events hard sometimes because I like to do my nighttime stories with the boys and things like that. I don't think it's necessarily about being there all the time because that can do stuff for both a mother or a father's mental health as well, which isn't necessarily helpful. I do think it's important that when you're there, you're really there, though. So technology hasn't helped in that regard. And, you know, it's very tempting to flick through a phone while you're sitting with your boy or your girl or anywhere in between that of any kind of gender, really, anyone you're looking after. And it's so important, if you can, that you're there and that you talk to them. And some of the best moments I have with both boys, particularly my younger one at the moment because he's very conversational, are at a breakfast table or at the evening dinner table too. And I'll ask him about something he's been reading or some cards he has. And so he's showing me through these Disney cards last night and he's telling me them character by character. And this is, you know, Elsa, and this is this one, and this is that one. And, you know, there's a new Star Wars character, I think Ahsoka, who I hadn't come across. And so it's pretty wonderful to have grown up around Star Wars so profoundly and then be introduced to a character you don't know by your children. So I think musically, Star Wars based, every world that they inhabit, they bring something in that I wouldn't have come across otherwise.
Well, I hope it continues to rain tacos.
Thank you so much, Danae. It's raining tacos from out of the sky. Tacos, no need to ask why, just open your mouth.